Steve Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from the heart of Manhattan and Rockefeller Center, New York City, Newsstand Studios, joined as usual with John behind me. How you doing?
Doing great, thanks.
Yeah, everything good?
Yeah.
Not wearing your Kent, you're not, no longer repping Kent, Connecticut, you're on to Pizza Planet?
I guess.
It's not really a planet, whatever.
Rotating.
Got Joe Hazen rocking the panels, what's up?
Hey, how are you? Welcome.
Yeah. Los Angeles, we got our Los Angeles crowd, we got Jackie Molecules and Anastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you folks doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Upper left corner there in Vancouver Island. Quinn, how you doing?
I'm good.
And today's special guest in the studio, actual longtime friend, known for a long time, both Nastasia and myself, famed chef and now expat Andy Ricker. How you doing?
I'm doing just swell. And you, Dave?
Great. So for those of you that don't know, in like the mid-aughts?
It was when I opened here.
No, the original Pock.
Oh, the original Pock Pock was 2005.
Yeah, okay. So 2005, people were like, the best Thai restaurant in America is in Portland. And we're like, you're stupid. You're a dummy. The hell do you know about anything at all? This is like, first of all, like 2005 was probably the height of New York chauvinism in American restaurant scene because we had kind of thrown off the shackles of needing to look up to our, you know, European counterparts, and we were our own people. And then, but definitely it was New York. And so the idea that like the best Thai restaurant that you could easily go to in the United States was run by a white dude in Portland, Oregon was absurd, but yet true.
Well, it was absurd, actually. It's completely absurd, and I agree with that.
Yeah.
But that was 20 years ago, almost.
Yeah, it's wild. And then, like, I don't know, like 10 years later, you, like, opened some Pock Pocks here.
2011, I planted the flag, very end of 2011.
Right before the pandemic, you were like, I'm out. Or right after.
Right as the pandemic descended on us, like, basically, I was in Thailand, and I was there from Christmas of 2019, and we started seeing, you know, the local news was covering China a lot, and there were drones in the street telling grandmas to go home.
Oh, yeah, in
Wuhan or whatever.
Yeah.
And we had direct flights from Wuhan coming into both Bangkok and Chiang Mai. I think one of the first documented cases of COVID was a Bangkok taxi driver who died of it, and potentially a woman died in a hotel room in Chiang Mai as well around then. And so I went home on like March 12th or something.
Home to Chiang Mai.
Home from Thailand back to Portland.
Right.
And, you know, arrived in America. And, you know, meanwhile, like a whole nursing home full of people died in Seattle. I landed in Seattle and nobody was wearing a mask. Nobody seemed to give a shit.
Crap. Yes.
Yes.
Family show.
Yep. Oh, sorry.
Answer.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Don't worry about it. Nastasi's like, yes.
Can't wait to hear the beep on that one. Yeah. And, you know, in my opinion, I thought, oh my God, we're doomed. And it didn't take me long. By August of 2020, I was in Thailand living there permanently. I had sold all the leases on my restaurants. I had sold the property that I owned. I had sold my clothes. I sold a bunch of my guitars and stuff. I was like, this is it. I'm out. And I just shut everything down.
But when I spoke to you, you were like, man, this is making me happy. You're like, dang, I'm so happy. It seems like I should be depressed, but I'm so happy.
To be done with it all?
Yeah. I mean, the guitars even though?
When's the last time you ran a restaurant?
I'm about to work on it again, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Pandemic shut down the last place I had to, you know, it was a bar, but, you know, the last place that I had to like worry about, you know, was everyone going to get their paychecks and all that stuff. And
yeah. Well, I had, at the time that we shut down, I had 175 employees, and like 8 restaurants. And I just didn't, I was like knocking on 60. Floyd Cardoz had just died, which scared the shit out of me, and was a terribly sad thing, too, because he was an awesome guy and a great chef. And, you know, Tony Bourdain had died, you know, the year before, and I started just kind of thinking about my mortality and the fact that I was tired and just, you know, did the math and decided that it's time to just give it up.
Nine Thailand football.
Cowardly, maybe? I don't know.
Who cares? No, that's
in the face of the charge, I backed down.
That's the thing I think that kind of ticks me off most about like any profession, which is a lot of them, which are underpaid for the amount of work you have to do a good job. So like there's a ton of jobs like that, right? Like architects, chefs, you know, all these jobs. It's like the only way that they continue to work at a high level is for everyone in the industry to self-reinforce that somehow if you can't keep doing this thing that is in some ways not really okay, that you're the problem. You know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know, you shouldn't buy into that crap. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, it was, I already had, my life was mostly in Thailand already. My wife was there. My cats, all six of them were there. It was the only place where I like.
So you sold the guitars and not the cats?
Yes. Yes. The cats wouldn't have fetched much.
Were they fancy guitars?
Yes. I had started collecting vintage instruments at some point.
Like what kind?
You know, the usual Fender, Guild, Gibson.
Yeah. More of a Tele, more of a Strat. Like, what are you?
Anything but a Strat.
Yeah, I bought Dax a Tele, and he was like a kind of Strat. I'm like, no, everyone has a Strat. Kid.
Also, Strats are a bit to play if you're not like really good, because they've got that volume knob right at the strings. And if you're like really good, that's great. And if you're not, if you're a thug like me, you're constantly like turning the volume off on accident while you're chugging away.
Also, unless you're in a hair band, why do you need that wah-wah pedal? That tremolo freaking bar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, why do you need that?
The whammy bar.
Yeah, why do you need the whammy bar for?
I don't know. I was my job in bands was a rhythm thug. I was primarily a bass player.
Oh, yeah.
And then when I played guitar, I was the rhythm guy. So I didn't need any all that stuff. I was just like, you know.
Plus, you know, I don't know if you know this, but your finger can bend the strings. You don't need...
Oh,
you don't need, yeah, dude. You don't need to like let go.
Playing instruments since I was like 12, and I never thought.
Yeah,
of that.
Yeah, yeah. Your finger can do it.
Damn.
Yeah. You know, and you sit there like the only way to make the pitch change is just take this bar and be like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I guess there is something very 80s about just dropping the whole thing out into like slack and then like coming back up into it, and making those noises. But I don't know. Who needs it?
You can do it with a pedal now. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Do it all electronically.
Do it all electronic.
You don't even need a guitar, right? You don't even need musicians. Watch this. Yeah. Hey, Joe, write some AI crap for us right now. Like, give me some AI. I would like something in the vein of like Rick James and George Harrison. Yeah, I mean, and he can write it.
Yeah.
So who needs people? I'm kidding.
No tangent Tuesdays.
Yeah.
On cooking issues.
We skipped over. We should go back to this. Is the portion on the show where we shoot the breeze over anything we've done in the past week. You're here for a pop up. So any interesting cooking problems you've had? First of all, what's this pop up and why now? Why here? Why?
So I'm doing a moldy little pop up at Mom Restaurant on Lower East Side with Gerald and his wife Nung. I'm only doing the chicken wings. And the older I get, the less interested I am in doing like very complicated pop-ups. So this seems pretty
suck.
Easy. It's a pain in the butt. It's rarely beneficial to everybody except for the people who come.
Yeah. You can source chicken wings here too.
Oh yeah. No, we went right back to our supplier that we used when we were here and got
exactly.
Who
do you use?
It was DeBraga.
DeBraga. Yeah. You weren't a Bobo? Because that used to be in the neighborhood back when you were there.
No, they get them from like Pennsylvania, from the Amish or something like that. They're good quality.
Amish chicken.
Yeah.
You got your Buddhist chicken, your Amish chicken, and then all the other chickens.
And then, but you know, when you only use wings.
Yeah.
I've never tried to get wings from Bobo before.
They just
sold whole chickens, right? Or they do everything now?
Yeah, no, they have whole chickens, Buddhist chicken, with a little tag in the wings.
Yeah, we used to do that. We used to do that when we made some of the Northern Thai dishes, but... You know, for the wings, we use this other stuff.
Your wings aren't fermented like your ribs used to be, are they?
No, they're not fermented. They're marinated in fish sauce, sugar, salt, garlic, like overnight. So it's kind of like a brine, but like a really thick brine.
What's your go-to not crazy expensive fish sauce these days?
Well, for this, we're using Red Boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Red Boat, good product.
And I have visited, I have to admit, I was a Red Boat skeptic. Because of the price and everything. But then I visited their factory in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and I'm a convert. I do think that they're making some of the finest fish sauce in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if I'm not using that, I'll use MegaChef Blue Label.
Yeah, I like MegaChef because of the way it sounds. I imagine the original chairman from the original Japanese Iron Chef saying MegaChef.
Do you know who the original MegaChef was?
No.
David Thompson.
Come on, really?
When they released the first...
For those who don't know, he wrote this thick, thick, thick book on Thai cuisine. He's Australian. Umpteen years ago, that was for a while in the English language, the book, right?
It kind of still is in a way. It's actually made by the Squid brand, which is the most ubiquitous of all fish sauces and pretty good quality. And they wanted to do a premium product, so they approached David to be the, and for a while there, you could go to the store, buy MegaChef Brown Label Thai formula, and there'd be a hang tag with David's face on it.
Really?
And so we used to call him MegaChef. I think in my phone, I still have him as MegaChef.
MegaChef!
Which he hates, by the way.
MegaChef. What's the difference between the blue and the brown? We only get the blue.
You can get the brown as well, but really? The Blue Label is their Vietnamese formula.
Right.
Lighter, sweeter. And they launched it here because they wanted to compete directly with Three Crabs brand, which the Korean market uses for making banchan. So they wanted to compete directly with that. So they undercut the Three Crabs in price. It's a very good product, though.
Yeah.
It's not available in Thailand. You can only get it overseas.
MegaChef, man. MegaChef, baby.
MegaChef.
Paul Adams, other friend of the show, did a thing where they measured the amino content of like a bunch of the different sauces, and MegaChef had a high umami wallop.
Oh, how interesting.
That was a long time ago, though. Things might have changed. Who knows?
I think they stuck with the formula.
Who knows, man?
Who knows?
Who knows, dude? I mean, have you tried the new garum from Mítica out of Spain?
Nope.
It's ridiculous.
Nope.
Lee priced. But it does taste good, though.
I tried some very, very expensive, very pure stuff from... I think it's from Portugal, and they're like making it in the old stone basins.
Same people.
Is it the same one?
Mítica, probably it's like all on that coast.
Okay.
And it's brought in by Mítica, who's primarily a Spanish brand.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure it's the same folks. I mean,
it's got to be.
Then the problem is the Italian, like, so Di Paolo's, you know, my folks down there, they're like, it's like Colatura. I'm like, it's not like Colatura. Not like Colatura at all. So they carried it, but I can't get them to taste it. So they have it on the shelves, but I don't even think they've tasted it. It's really good.
I tried it in Lisbon. I had like a pin drop dropper taste of it because it costs like 30 euros for 100 milliliters or something like that. It's just crazy.
It's nuts. Yeah.
But, you know, it's some dude, you know, naked pulling fish out of the ocean. And I don't know what the hell's going on there.
That's a nightmare right there.
Yeah.
It's like Saturn eating his sons, people with fish, like pulling fish out, chewing them and spitting them and their guts into a bucket. Yum. What about you guys over there on that coast? Anything interesting happen this week in the world of food?
Not this week, but Andy, I have to say, man, I cooked through, I'd say maybe 60-70% of your book, the Pak book, through during COVID. It's what kept me sane, and I hunted down all the spices and ingredients. There, I was living in D.C. and Falls Church had some good markets where I could get most of the stuff, and it was great. So. Yeah,
oh, that's
thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I have to say that you've been beaten by one couple. It was a Polish couple who moved to Iceland. And then they cooked my entire book, reshot it, like shot pictures of every dish, did a desktop publishing thing and sent it to me.
Now, but every herb was substituted with lamb's head?
They made it look really legit. I don't know. Maybe there's like some kind of flight that goes from Bangkok to Reykjavik or whatever.
I don't know.
But they did it. And so when people say, oh, I can't find the ingredients to do it, I'm like, you know, Polish couple immigrates to Iceland, recreates the entire book.
I bet that couple was rich.
Maybe. Or maybe they're just bored. They just
because I have to say something like Iceland's incredibly beautiful. It's so expensive. It's so expensive.
Yeah.
Especially as an outsider.
You just triggered that memory. That happened kind of several years ago. I have to go back and find that thing because that kind of blew me away. I didn't really know what to say or do.
Get their permission and like post the side-bys.
Oh.
They're like the which director did the shot by shot psycho? Remember that? It's like
Gus Van Sant.
Yeah, Gus Van Sant. Yeah. Completely redid Psycho, Hitchcock Psycho, shot for shot. Like why? It's like being a cover band and like doing all the same vocal McGillas that the original person did. Mm-hmm. Why? You know?
Maybe it was for the cruise ship customers.
This is why I like a cover like Stevie Wonder's We Can Work It Out. Totally different. Totally different mm-hmm. song from the Beatles.
Yep, absolutely. You know what I mean? Yep. There is a guy in Portland, Oregon named Rick Bain. He had a band called The Genius Position or something like that. And he recreated Pet Sounds entirely on like weird instruments on a cassette deck.
So he's like
the whole Pet Sounds album,
like Ween style, like on like a four track.
Yeah, on a four track using like unconventional instruments. And he completely recreated the whole Pet Sounds album. Yeah. It was amazing. Yeah.
It sounded okay.
Sounded great.
Yeah.
It's a really cool record.
All right. Yeah. Mick Bain. All right. What about you, Quinn? You always have something interesting going on up there in the upper left.
I didn't have too much this weekend, but I do have stuff I didn't talk about last week. Actually, 2 weeks ago,
right.
I did a stuffed saddle of rabbit, which turned out pretty good.
All right. Did you have the bones removed? I hope.
My brother did that.
Uh-oh. So how many bones were left over in it? Or did your brother do a good job?
Yeah, because what we did is we took off, like, you know, all the legs. We ground the legs with pork belly to make, like, a farce.
Mm-hmm.
And then my brother did a decent job boning out the actual, like, spine.
Oh, God, I hate boning those things. That's why I don't cook them.
Well, you could just go fee-fi-fo-fum and grind it up, you know, with the bones in it.
Yeah, that's a totally culturally different thing. Can you imagine? Like, if I served that to, like, my normal crew and, like, little bones, like, how hardcore would you have to go to emulsify it? Like, you might have prepped the whole thing, turn it into a hot dog situation, and just pulp the whole thing. I don't know, man. Question. Should we call things farces here in English? Because it sounds bad.
It sounds like a farce.
Sounds like a farce. Right, like we don't have the French connotations, as we know. Say it earlier, throwing off the shackles of that of the Franco. No offense, John, of the Francophile stuff. I mean, like, why call it a stuffing? Doesn't sound good, right?
Isn't it just a force meat? Isn't
it's meat, yeah, meat stuffing, right? Meat force meat. Yeah, but you can
sure. But like, what if it's not in something?
What do you mean?
Like, you don't have to stuff farce.
Then what is it? Something. Then it's a moose, like that's been canelled or something.
Yeah, but you don't. It doesn't say smooth.
No one says here's a ball of farce.
You but just like did.
Would describe,
that would be a farce.
I could describe the meatball mixture as a farce.
You could, but then why would you do that though?
Then what else are you gonna call it?
Meatball mixture.
But then you don't call a sausage a farce either.
Mm. Yeah.
So
you don't.
It's a bit of a
no sausage meat.
No, I mean, a cased sausage is not called a farce, is it?
No, but because when you buy it loose,
it's still called sausage.
Call sausage meat, yeah, loose sausage.
But see, now we're getting deep into it. When you say sausage to me, the first thing I think of is a tube steak.
Oh, tube steak.
You know, like something inside
I
something.
I never, ever call things tube steaks. Speaking of tube steaks, the Copenhagen, like, hot dog in a baguette could be so much better than it is. It's so not good compared to what it could be.
It's only edible if you're really, really drunk.
Yeah, but there's so many things that are like that. Like, if you're going to be drunk and eat something, the correct answer is doner kebab. A correct answer.
Oh.
There's not one correct answer. But
that is one of the things.
But if you had someone handing me a doner and then other person handing me a poorly made tube-shaped faux baguette with a hot dog shoved in it, I go for the donor.
Me too. Have you ever been to Sweden?
Yeah.
Have you had the half special?
No.
It's like the Danish thing, except for they put like shrimp salad on it.
Well, shrimp salad. Yummy, yummy. Shrimp salad.
Shrimp salad.
Yummy, yummy. You familiar with Wiggles? Yummy, 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 yummy shrimp salad. And then we have to pay them if we do any more. And they have that weird kind of atonal salad part. It's fruit salad is what it is.
I don't
have
know
you
that
had
at all.
Your fruit salad today. Uh-huh. You don't know the song?
Nope.
Joe, you know where I'm coming from. Joe knows. Joe's got that Wiggles action going on. The Wiggles, it's like every generation has their own kids' bullcrap. And so, like, my kids was like late Rafi, but like prime Wiggles.
They're exceptionally weird.
The wigs?
I really
the Wiggles
that.
Are.
I
mean, they look like they're out of Star Trek.
There's
they all look like they're on like some kind of unusual speed that we've never had here.
Well, they're from like Australia.
That's okay. That's okay. I get that.
And they are high out of their minds. Yeah.
Mm.
They're very good musicians.
Now I'm going to have to look this up.
Yeah. Like, yeah. What are your favorite Wiggles tunes, Joe?
You know what? We left the Wiggles. Now we're on to Steve and Maggie. Another, I think they're, and that might be Australian. It's with a magpie and someone named Steve.
That's not in my, it must be newer.
It's newer. The songs are great. His smile is bizarre.
Do you know who doesn't, you know who takes himself so seriously in a good way is Rafi. Have you ever heard Rafi talk?
No, I've actually, we haven't watched Rafi yet.
Okay, so Rafi, you know, famous, like, Canadian of Egyptian ethnicity Canadian singer. But like, you're like, oh, dude makes kids songs, right? But when you listen to him talk, he's basically like Mr. Rogers in that he takes children extremely seriously. In other words, as people and as, you know, like something to be kind of like treasured in a good way, like Mr. Rogers. Like, you know how you see old footage of Mr. Rogers and people try to like get him to like, be like, oh, this is goofy. You do kid stuff, right? He's like, no. And that's it. Like, totally dead. And I was like, well, I didn't expect Rafi to be like that.
So where are you accessing all this stuff? Is this like YouTube stuff?
Well, this is all Spotifyable now. Oh. You know what I mean?
How would you know to look for it?
Because like these kids' music, if you're ever
you
like
got kids.
Yeah, if you're ever in that kid stuff, it's like, you know. Yeah. But you've probably heard Baby Beluga in the Deep Blue Freaking Sea.
Nah.
Swim so wild and swim so free.
Yeah.
Banana phone.
But you don't know about Baby Shark yet, do you?
Baby Shark.
I've had to do Baby Shark.
You know that song, I'm a Banana?
No.
That's the only kids thing that I've heard. I don't think it's a kids thing, but it's pretty hardcore. It's just some dudes screaming, I'm a banana at the top of their lungs.
I'm glad that this was
It's the only thing that I was in. Like, my friend Bowen Dillon from Bolan Restaurant in Bangkok, they've got kids, and these kids find stuff. And then they make me listen to it. And that was the best thing.
Is it better or worse than the Buckwheat Boys Peanut Butter Jelly Time?
I have no idea.
You've no Peanut Butter Jelly Time.
No, we can put them up against each other and
listen,
see.
Listen, Peanut Butter Jelly Time is one of the great early, like...
Early know, what?
Early like...
21st century?
did it come out before... It was like 2002 or 2001.
Yeah. I listened to Dr. Demento when I was a kid.
Hell yeah,
That's my
fish heads, fish heads, roly poly fish heads, fish heads, fish heads, eat them up, yum.
All that stuff. Dr. Demento from the 70s and 80s and stuff.
Dr. Demento, yeah. Like he used to collect really like weird, wacky albums, but like stuff that I used to.
That stuff from the 30s and the 20s and like all the way up through.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of like 50s, like 45 novelty tunes like Monster Mash and all that kind of,
but even garbage. More obscure and sometimes risque.
Yeah. Well, you know, with a name like Demento, wasn't he a West Coast dude?
I can't remember. I was young.
Yeah. Yeah. I was saying this earlier. This has nothing to do with food, but like, you know what people don't have anymore? Like, people who are LP people, right? Like vinyl, like when in the 70s, when you had a vinyl record player, you put like 5 discs on top of each other, and then you had that little L-shaped arm that rested on top. No one would ever do that to their vinyl now because it's scratching the hell out of their vinyl,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then as soon as it got to the end, it would go, boom, it would lift up the needle, move it over, it would go click, dack, and it would drop the next LP on and go. You could listen to like 3 hours, but only one side.
Only the A side.
Yes.
Or the B, whatever the B
side. Yeah,
I know. My dad had my father's Sansui. Or is it Sansui? No. I can't remember the name of it. Anyways, yeah. I broke it as a little kid.
Yeah, of course you did.
Playing my little Ernie and Bert.
That was what we used to call lo-fi.
Lo-fi.
Lo-fi record players.
When was the last time you guys saw one with a tall center post that it could do that?
No, we didn't have a loaf. My father had a quadraphonic setup, so it was pretty.
But he still had the turntable that could stack?
Yes.
Wow.
It's really bad for the records.
So bad.
Oh, Dual. D-U-A-L.
But that was the German.
Oh, dude, that was like super high quality. That was like kind of the one that you wanted to get.
Yeah, it's a very coveted record. It still is.
All right. Yep. So for the old folk, I had a lot of Tandy stuff from the Radio Shack.
Ooh, yeah.
Remember Radio Shack?
Tandy, yes.
Tandy.
Remember Radio
what?
Shack?
What? I never thought I'd ever hear anyone ever say that. Do you remember Radio Shack?
I mean, it's been long enough to that we've forgotten
get this,
Radio
get
Shack.
Get this, get this, get this. Yeah, it has been. Like, that was one of the great early mess-ups when they sent an email to everyone saying, R.E., your former job. That's how they fired, like, all of their people. A real, really poorly run corporation towards the end.
It was too early to GameStop them, too.
Yeah, I used to buy so much stuff at Radio Shack, like components, that a guy offered me a job once. I was like, nah. I was like, no.
So back to the music thing, when I was in bands and we recorded, there was like a really famous mic that you got at Radio Shack. And it was, I can't remember what it was called, but it came on a metal plate and it was used as a room mic. It was cheap. It was like $40 or something like that.
I remember it.
And it was a really specific model of Radio Shack mic.
It was like bulletproof?
And every studio had it. It had this really unique sort of ability to pick up the entire room.
It was the realistic PZM.
Is that what it was?
Really?
It sure was.
Oh, yeah, because Realistic was their other brand.
Yeah. That was the in-house company. The PZM was the, what does it stand for? It's a flat, where it's a mic that picks up basically 180 degrees.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they put it on the floor in front of the drum, or they put it on the wall to pick up the whole room. It was pretty cool.
When I was a kid, my dad is double E engineer, right? And so he's used to build computers. That's what he did, computers and lasers. And so in the, like, right when they came out, everyone was getting these Apple IIe's. Remember the green screen Apple IIe's?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My dad got me the Radio Shack, the TRS-80. And so, like, I didn't even want to use it because everyone else, all the cool rich kids in my neighborhood, and my dad was like, but these specs are actually better. Nobody cares about specs. I might as well have had the shirt with the dragon on it instead of the polo. For those of you that remember that shirt from Sears. Yeah. My grandma got me that shirt from Sears. You know what it's like to go, like, you know, I don't know, like all the kids in my neighborhood when we moved all had all that polo crap. And I had my grandma's little dragon shirt from Sears. Makes me feel like an idiot. You know what I mean? I don't know. Anyone else have these kind of experiences growing up? I'm sure people do. Everyone does. Yeah. I'm being told by John, back to food. All right. So, do you guys, what about you, Stas? You do any food?
I was in Sedona with my sister, and there's no good food.
That is not true at all.
There's got to be at least a taqueria or two.
Or 12. I was just in Phoenix.
I went to a Mexican place and there was no spice in the food because there's so many white people in Sedona.
Oh, well, God. Sedona specifically is full of freak shows and weirdos. No offense to them. But like, it's like super pretty, but it's like, I cannot get out of that place fast enough. My father-in-law used to fly in there out of Phoenix. He would fly into the Sedona airport. And man, if I never see another person, like, you know, cross-legged with a crystal in there, you know, in front of them, like in that kind of situation again, like it's too soon. So maybe it's just Sedona, but I had a lot of good food in Phoenix when I was there, which is pretty close.
Like, yeah, I'm sure Phoenix is great. We did not spend any time there.
Why Sedona? Were you doing some sort of crystal healing thing? Were you like shoving crystals in your unmentionables or something?
Yeah, actually, we put them.
No, not particularly. But what were you doing there? Why Sedona?
Just hiking and going through.
Mm. What time of year
My
is it?
My sister had never been to Grand Canyon either.
Oh, you went up to Flagstaff?
Yeah, and we went to the Grand Canyon. Yeah.
Cold now. Did you go all the way down?
Very cold. No.
I went there once during this time of year and I slipped and fell, and I'm told that I was like 100 feet away from the edge, but I'm so afraid of heights that I screamed in such a high timbre that someone thought that a small child had been punched across the parking lot, and we were like, to hell with it. And we never went. I just got as close so I could see over the edge and we never walked down. I'm never walking down that Grand Canyon. Not ever. No way. You can Mr. T me. You can knock me out. And then put me on the back of one of those
mules
and take me down and have me wake up when I get to the bottom. But I'm never going to walk down the side of that thing. Did your feet hurt?
Yeah.
I'm told that.
That was good way to get it back on food. There.
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing.
Way to get back on food.
I'll give you some food. I'll give you some food. So I was, you know, I do family dinner every week. And so, like, I got a bunch of cheese from DiPaolo's. And one of my favorite cheesemakers is Beppe Ocello, who is a Piemontese guy. And he makes this cheese, Testun, which means hard head. It's a variety of cheeses. My favorite of his two favorites he makes is he makes, it's a mixture of sheep and cow's milk cheese aged for, you know, like 18, 24 months, something like that, wrapped in chestnut leaves. Stupendous cheese. He also does one like that with wheat that, you know, some wheat and whiskey on the outside. Also fantastic. But he made one that he called pizza cheese, which is the same Testum, but with like weird, like American style, looks like a deep dish kind of pizza. And so I served it to Wiley Dufresne, my brother-in-law, who, you know, makes pizzas. And he was like, it tastes like this person, this is his conception of what an American eating, because he doesn't sell this in Italy, this one. It's like, this is his perception of what an American thinks pizza is. Weird. That's my only food story.
How bizarre.
Yeah. And I've been trying to make that Portuguese bread broa that I talked about with Ariel. And I can't get it the way that I used to make it because I'm not using any, I just need to move to maybe using refined flour. I'm using all completely fresh, you know, home ground stuff. And I just can't get it to be, because I used to make it all the time.
You might need to use a mixture.
I don't know if I'm going to use a mixture. I might just go all the way to, you know, good old fashioned American roller milled products. You know what I mean? I mean, they have their place, it's just not in my house. What am I? Well, either go one way or the other, my man. You know how I feel. You feel your way, I feel my way. That's it, you know? All right. So, let's see. I was reading the intro to Pock Pock, or not the intro, but David Thompson's intro. So, like, you got into this whole cooking thing because of a mushroom? What's this mushroom? What's this fancy mushroom?
So, first of all, I got into Thai food seriously because of a mushroom. I'd been cooking since I was 15 by the time I got to this. I was a wage earner. My first job was a dishwasher at a fondue restaurant.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know who loves fondue?
Who's that?
Nastasia.
Don't ever be a dishwasher at a fondue restaurant.
Oh, Jesus. That sounds like a nightmare.
Baked on cheese. But the story with mushroom was that I went to Thailand in 1992. It was the first time I'd been to Chiang Mai. I'd been in Thailand before in the mid-80s. And I was there to visit a good friend of mine. His wife, Lakana, who is a professor at the university there, was like, well, do you like Thai food? And I was like, yeah. She said, well, she took me to a few places that serve like kind of regular, you know, stuff that I might be familiar with. And then she was like, well, do you want to try the local food? And it happened to be, this was May. And during April and May, right around this time of year, there's a mushroom that comes up after they burn the forest and it rains. So, and they're called het top, and they look like a puffball, kind of that same size, but darker color, almost black. And they have this incredible aroma, almost like, it's not like truffle, but it the intensity of smell is almost the same. When you cut it open, hopefully it's nice and white and puffball inside, but sometimes it's not. It's kind of, but they have this sort of like earthy taste and that smell. And we went somewhere and a guy was making a dish called Gang Het Top that had like pork ribs and lob spice and bitter herbs and tamarind and these mushrooms in it. And the flavor was unlike anything I'd had before, Thai or otherwise. And it was kind of an aha moment for me because it was like, well, oh, so this is only this time of year, so it's seasonal. This is a northern Thai style dish, so there's regional cuisine. This guy makes a specific version, so it's local. So Thailand has local, regional, seasonal cuisine, also based on what ethnic group you come from. And that was a revelation to me because before that, you know, you go to a Thai restaurant anywhere in the world, it was the same 50 to 100 different dishes.
Because kind of institutionalized, international,
exactly, yeah.
Thai-like.
Yeah, and it was...
Those are good dishes, though.
They're good, but it wasn't, like, there was no indication that there was anything else but that if you go to Thailand. And you arrive in Thailand, you go to all the tourist places.
And they're catering to tourists.
They're basically reinforcing this idea. So that was the beginning of like, holy crap, I've got to start looking at this more in depth. And that was it. I just kind of started going back again and again and again and trying to learn more.
Hey, speaking of, learning more and like weird things that nobody ever gets to eat, or not weird, but things that nobody ever gets to eat. You told me years ago that David Thompson was in possession, or maybe it was Weepop who told me. You ever meet Weepop, Supapipot, the person who did Nomiku, who's one, he now owns nightclubs in Bangkok?
No, I don't think I do.
Well, yeah. Tell me whether this was you that told me this or Weepop, but that, because he also knows Thompson, is in possession of old court cookbooks and like, no one's ever translated them and they're nowhere available, like old Thai court cookbooks.
Yeah. So that type of knowledge, David's not the only one who has them. Like everybody has them now. But he was the first one, I believe, who really started digging into that and applying them and putting them into modern use. But now he and his acolytes and, you know, various other people who have entered the fray or have been in the fray also have access to them. But it's true. It's in
like,
and
this is like you know, 15 years ago or something like that.
Oh, longer.
Yeah, talking about
30 years ago, yeah. he had or more. He basically a lot of what David's cooking has to do with is reinterpreting these things because the recipes aren't exact.
Right.
They're very vague.
I've never had his food, by the way.
Well, you're going to have to come to Thailand then.
Yeah. But what's the spin on that? Because from what I gathered, from what people have told me, it's an entirely, completely different style of cooking, court cooking.
Yeah. So imagine a time when there were the haves and the serious have nots. So like almost a feudal kind of structure.
Like today.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But except for there's a large middle class there now.
Right.
We got Hello Kitty and super malls at the moment. Yeah. So the only place that really could afford to experiment with food were the royal courts because they had money and they gathered ties. People would bring them stuff. They could import things. And food was a very important thing. So a lot of the people who worked in the kitchens in the royal courts would kind of apply not only ancient ideas but modern ideas as well to the recipes. But like I can't read those things, and you know, but my understanding is that you know the measurements would be like one rice bowl of pork ribs, one baht of palm sugar, you know, like kind of like old
baht, the unit of money.
Baht, yeah, which is based on a weight, and one spoon, like what kind of spoon? Nobody knows. So basically, the ingredients are there, and the technique is there, and you know, David would work with these things until he got something that tasted good, and then he'd refine it and change it and refine it and change it. And that's, you know, that's a lot of his cooking is based on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you still, so right now you're running food tours, right? Can anyone get one of these things or no?
Yeah. Anybody who has money.
Well, that's the idea. But like, how, you know, you've been going there since 87 regularly, yeah. Living there. You used to live there even like a couple of months a year, no matter what, to kind of recharge your mental batteries.
I'd be there 3 to 5 months a year for, you know, for a long time now. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I mean, how much different of experience do you get like being plugged into someone who's an outsider, but an insider, right? Because you know, we were talking before the show, mm-hmm. you still very much realize that you are an American when you're there.
Yeah, yeah.
You, even though you're living there,
sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
Even though, and your wife is Thai, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But you're still feel
yeah,
like
I'm an still a foreigner, yeah.
Right. So, but how, like, what kind of different experience? Because I guess you just have the knowledge if you know, that.
I think it's the same thing that allowed me to do what I did at Pok Pok, which is that I have a nominal understanding of the Thai food culture, and I've got a very good understanding of American food culture, and I'm able to interpret both ways. So, I'm able to answer questions that Westerners are likely to ask, I guess is the best way to put it.
I mean, like, I'm just thinking about that when I'm dealing with, you know, in business environments with other cultures, like, yeah, mm-hmm. that's a very specific skill.
And I'm, you know, I'm still absolutely a student of Thai culture and cuisine. There's so much more to learn. But the stuff, and you know, there are people that I go see again and again and again, and I, you know, I'm able to show people like, here's this thing, and this is what it means, and this is what it represents, and here's the people who are doing it. They've been doing it for X amount of time. Here's the little tiny technical, like if we go to visit a Khun Aum Chin factory, for instance, a place where they make the rice noodles of a particular type, I understand the process that they're going through. If you walked in, you would be able to figure it out because you're, you know, that's what you do. You figure it out like that.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
But to the casual observer, they'd be just like, what is going on here? I just don't understand it. And I'm able to say, well, look, you know, they're going to boil the fermented rice flour dough in the water till it's half cooked, because that's a, in food technology, what is that? When you boil half, like half cook a dough, like you mix a cooked dough with a raw dough.
You mean like you would for like a choux pastry or broa, which I was talking about, or like wrappers or things like that.
Right.
Well, it's just increasing the hydration of the, it's increasing the hydration of its ability to hold water by pre-gelatinizing some of the starch.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I wouldn't have been able to place, but that's what they do. And I don't think that they could necessarily express it that way, but they know that they have to do it.
Man.
So I'm able to explain what's going on. Whereas if you just came, you might get with a local tour guide who isn't like focused on food, might not have the right way of explaining to a Western tourist more precisely what's going on. I'm going to use that, by the way.
Yeah, there you go.
Also, like, pre-gelatinization.
Yeah, but why would somebody know what a food nerd wants to know unless they're themselves a food nerd?
This is true.
You know what I'm saying?
This is true.
Do you have any food tours that revolve around going to that rocket festival that you used to show me videos of?
No, but...
By the way, for these who don't know, you got to... What's the name of the thing? People got to look up this festival.
It's called Bang Phai Pha, which is... And it's held in various different places in Isan. Essentially, it's a way of inviting rain to come for the rice harvest. And they shoot rockets
like
into the sky.
People. Homemade, big,
dangerous,
big, and like people are like walking up and lighting with a match or with a torch a rocket that is like four times taller than they are.
Yeah,
like I'm not talking, these are like big,
and they used to make them out of bamboo, but now they make them. No, they make them out of PVC pipes.
Oh,
because PVC pipes are
or less dangerous, same dangerous.
I would say, I don't know the answer to that. I would say maybe a little bit less.
I mean, the videos are just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
There's no good food built around that though?
No, they just party down, man. It's just a big party. And
it's all about running away.
It's about, it's about drinking copious. I mean, they're all, this is the other thing. The guys that are doing this are wasted on rice whiskey.
That makes it safer?
That makes, just makes you plausible deniability that anything wrong is going to happen.
Yeah.
But I'm, they have like drinking food typically would be.
Well, you had a whole book.
I had a whole book about drinking food. That's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
And you also used to import these crazy, like, you would find people whose like business was to take one machine and turn it into a food machine.
Yes.
Like you had you used to have these washing machines that this guy used to customize for you that would sit there and they would oscillate.
Chunk, chunk, chunk. And there'd be a wound machine.
Yeah. It was like beer and crushed ice and salt, and it would chunk, 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 chunk. And then you would open your beer and go clunk, and it would just ice up immediately.
It would ice up once you agitated it. Now this is going to be another food science thing. It should stay liquid.
Yeah.
Right.
You had to get it just right though, right?
But you had to get it just right. And it the key was it would hold sort of indefinitely in there at the temperature, which is like right at or above freezing. So salt water and ice together makes...
It's colder, but because of all of the carbon dioxide in it and because it's under pressure and there's no nucleation sites in it, you don't get any crystallization. So you can either keep it like at its freezing point when it's in a bottle or slightly subcooled. And then when you pop it, the CO2 blasts out, which A, lowers the freezing point. Sorry, raises the freezing point, and B, provides nucleation sites with those bubbles. And so you hit it, and blammo, it just...
Yeah, so what we would do, there are two things that I would do when you serve it. One would be to, before you open it, you tap the bottle on the floor, just on the corner, boom, and then you turn it upside down. And when you turn it right side up again... It would wound, we'd say, turn to plastic, basically. So it would turn to slush, and then you drink it out of a straw. The other thing you could do was pop the lid off, don't hit it, it'd still be liquid, and you'd pour it into a glass with a single ice cube in it, and as it hit the ice cube, it would turn to slush. It's coming out totally liquid beer. As soon as it hit the ice cube, it turns to slush in the cup. So it's kind of like a magic trick.
Yeah, I like a magic trick.
Yeah.
You know, and then they were doing that in, what was that famous Tokyo restaurant that was doing a lot of super cooling, and then the Spanish did a lot of super cooling, mm-hmm. like Drake was a thing for a while. But you, then, you know, you were doing it with a, you know, they were doing it in Thailand with washing machines since forever, right?
Well, they do it. They had the hand ones, but at first they were used to make like popsicles.
On a windshield wiper motor. That's what it was. Yeah, it was a windshield wiper motor.
On a barrel.
Yeah.
But they had the manual ones before, the stainless steel things. It was the same idea. You'd have a little jacket and you'd stick a like syrup and fruit flavor and put a stick in it. And then you go like this, agitate it by hand, and those would freeze into a popsicle. And those didn't stay liquid, right? Because there's no alcohol in them. Am I correct? Is it the alcohol in the beer that stops it from...
Alcohol will lower the freezing point, but it's the shifting of the freezing point with opening it under pressure, and the fact that the gas leaves is, I think, the main... And those little micronucleation sites. You can do it with water, with straight water, without any sort of pressure shift like that. You need to keep it very still and very clean so that there's no sites. And then you hit it or throw something in and it just crystallizes out, or pour it on an ice cube, as you say. It's a trick that a lot of people have, you know, done in the high end kind of gimmick world. But I think it's cooler to just have it not just be like something that, like, get me a beer and it ices up.
You go to a lob joint where you're eating raw meat with blood and offal and stuff in it, and they'll have super cooled beer, and they just come to the table and be wounded. It's nothing better, man.
Yeah, ice cold beer. I don't know if you know. Ice cold beer.
There's another Thai food technology, what do you call it? Molecular gastronomy move. which is they use something called nembunsai, which is limestone paste.
Oh, I love that stuff.
Acidulated water with the limestone paste, and you add it to batters, and it makes stuff super crispy.
We used to use that crap all the time on bananas.
Yeah, you can cook them, and they'll stay firm.
Hard as hell. But what's the difference between the red and the white lime paste?
Nothing, like from a chemical standpoint. The red stuff is what you're supposed to use for food. The white stuff is used for ceremonial purposes.
Now, I used to use that all the time. I bought it. There's a Thai grocery on. Actually, it's the one part of the old Five Points in. If you know New York, like kind of downtown history, Five Points was. I kind of like fought mainly because of prejudices. Was called like the worst neighborhood in Manhattan, but it was leveled and they built all the courthouses down there. But it was where Five Streets kind of. And if you watch Gangs of New York, you can kind of see a recreation of that. But there's that street, Moscow, where the Thai grocery is one of the
Bangkok
only places,
Market,
where you can physically, if you squint just right, you can see where the Five Points used to be and what it kind of looks like.
So that's on Moscow down by Mulberry. Would that have been?
So Moscow is one of the original streets that ran right into the Five Points, and you can kind of see the angles that kind of made it. And if you don't see the big Center Street buildings, you can kind of feel it for a second if you feel yourself just right. So I walked in there and they wouldn't take credit card for the amount of stuff that I had to buy. And so I was like, what are these jars? What are those? And he goes, lime paste. I'm like, lime paste? I thought he meant like the fruit lime. I'm like, all right. He's like, red or white? I'm like, I don't care. And he gave me one and I had to figure out what to do with it. And that's when we started doing these like, we would vacuum, we would make the lime water. So it's like, It's calcium hydroxide, similar to what they use for nixtamalization in Mesoamerican cuisine. And, you know, you have to make this water, and then we would vacuum infuse it into bananas, and holy crap, you could just beat the ever-loving snot out of those bananas, even if they're dead ripe, and they won't break.
So that is one of the classic uses of nembunsai, is to cook bananas. So you soak them in acidulated lime water, nembunsai, and you boil them and they don't get soft, and then you eat that with coconut cream, like warm coconut. And we call it gluay buchi.
Yeah,
you can do it with pumpkin as well.
Good,
so, very good. Yeah, very good.
If you overdo it, it's weird.
Yeah,
if you soak it too long, or if it gets it gets weird. Yeah,
but the number one use for it is if you want to make the crispiest fried chicken batter ever, use that water instead of water.
What's regular wheat starch base?
Yeah. Whatever starch you're using, just add that water instead, and you get like the crispiest.
As 100% of the what's it called?
Yep.
Yeah. So it should also brown like a mother, unless you add a lot of acid back to it.
It browns pretty damn good. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you add a little bit of MSG to that, actually, your batter will turn pink and you get a really nice color.
Well, I like that. The I have not found another thing that I bought there once. I couldn't find a good use for are those candles, the scented candles.
Oh, Tinholm. Yeah.
Is there a there a use that I would like the flavor of for those candles?
Well, if you don't like the flavor, then you don't like the flavor. I actually love the flavor. It's used extensively in Thai sweets, kanom. So you can smoke sugar with it. You can smoke flour with it. Those really, are the two most common
things. Is it always waxy or is I doing it wrong? It has like not just the aroma of the candle, but like a real...
Well, here's the problem. The stuff that you're getting here is not high quality. If you want the good stuff, you got to go to Bangkok and buy like these, you know, this very expensive versions that people are still making by hand. The stuff you get that comes from the supermarkets here is low grade crap.
Mm.
So you need the good stuff. But if you get that and then you know, you burn it from both ends, it's U-shaped, right?
Yeah.
You set it in a cup, you burn both ends, you put the stuff in the same, you know, like a cold smoke kind of situation. And you can smoke liquid with it. You can add it. It'll absorb into liquid. It'll absorb into sugar, flour, and then you make stuff with that. And then you get that really beautiful flavor. I love it. Some people, it's polarizing, kind of like durian.
Yeah, or like water bug essence.
Yeah. That stuff, generally speaking, I don't dig that much. You know what tastes just like that? It's the weirdest thing. Absolute pear.
Yeah. Well, no, it's because of those esters. It's very so estery. Weird. So like, yeah. For those of you that don't know what we're talking about the giant water bug.
Mengda. We call Mengda.
Yeah. Which, you know, everyone was trying to source, and I was trying to get you to find me a source because McGee wanted some, and someone else wanted them in here.
I'll tell
you
exactly where to get it.
In New York?
Yeah. You go to the market across from Sipapai. And here's the thing, I do not believe that they're legal to import as a food product, so they get imported as fish bait.
But they're frozen.
They're frozen. But you can get the same thing out of it.
Are they just as good frozen?
To be honest, I don't ever cook with them.
Yeah.
But it'll work.
How close do they smell to the fake essence that you can get at all the stores?
Oh, the fake essence is horrible.
That's the stuff that smells like nail polish and bananas and like the pear
it's awful.
Liqueur. Yeah.
It's awful.
Is it similar to that?
Similar, yeah. But the way that I had it first was this thing called Nemprik Mengda, which is Nemprik Noom, the green chili paste from the north. But they add some of the Mengda, some of the gland. They squeeze it.
Squeeze
fast.
A little bug?
Yeah.
It's big bug.
Big bug. And they mixed it into that, and then I had it with like a steamed fish or something. And I found it to be interesting and not unpleasant, but it's not something I seek out.
Yeah, so you don't have like a little thing of cheesecloth with a bug in it? And
no,
like
no.
Like, and you little
lemon, bug.
Little lemon, little bug.
No. But people dig it, and, you know, it's... Think about the food of Thailand in this context. You're eating vast quantities of rice, right? Like, your staple, and you're going to eat... You know, every man, woman, and child's eating like a kilo or two of rice a day in the old days. So the cuisine got developed based on this idea that you have lots and lots of something that doesn't have a whole lot of flavor, and you need things that have flavor to kind of make it more interesting. So that can explain a lot of the kind of... also, you're talking about people who were living basically at the poverty line. So anything that is edible, that's interesting, ends up on the plate.
Now, what's your favorite thing to do with the black sticky that's not dessert?
That one, you can... Well, mostly what you use it is for dessert, but you can...
I really like that stuff.
It's really great. You can pound it into like a mochi-like thing, but mostly it's used for sweet stuff.
I mean, yeah, we used to use that for puffed rice.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
Because it tastes really good.
Yeah.
And it looks really good.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? But
totally.
Like...
Yeah. Well, you know what the other thing you do with it is you make lao khao. Rice whiskey.
Oh, yeah?
And when you make that, it turns purple, red.
Yeah, tastes good.
So the Chinese people use that a lot, actually, for making lao khao, the black rice.
Yeah. Yeah. I see. By the way, are you still selling binchatan or no?
No.
What's the Thai word for binchatan?
Tan.
All right. Just minus the bincho?
Yeah, tan just means charcoal in Thai. Mm. You know, it's not clear to me how do you describe etymology? The sort of like history of the word.
I don't know.
It probably comes from somewhere else. But tan is, we don't actually have, in Thailand, we don't make, quote, binchatan, unquote, because that's like a really specific property. But there is somebody in Thailand who started doing it, and that's who we were sourcing from. But I'm not involved in that company at all anymore.
No. All right. But you are still making cordials, vinegar-based cordials.
We've just closed that company down.
And you're shutting it all down, man.
Yeah, I'm done, man. That's it. I'm done.
Done. It's hanging out. All right. So let me see. Get to some questions here. Oh, we have a question from Suzanne Park. Wants to know, what is the food item you most miss from the United States? I mean, you get to come back sometimes, but.
Pho. It's the very first thing I have as soon as I get here. Oh my God,
that's so nuts.
Yeah. I mean, look, we have
really
great...
Wouldn't it be easier just to go to Vietnam?
Actually, it's pretty easy to go to Vietnam these days, but not just for a bowl of pho. So it's like, and we have plenty of other things in Thailand that are really, really good.
You're like, you know, yeah. I'm going to get a burger. Nope.
Well, I mean, you can get almost everything in Thailand, but you can get really good pizza there. But for some reason, the quality of pho, they're just partly because Thailand is not really a beef culture and Vietnam is.
I see. All right. So this is a question about Eli cocktails. So I'm opening a new place.
I heard. I hung out with Jeremiah the other day.
Yeah. Jeremiah and fabulous. All right. Yeah. Mark in Long Island saw a bottled Jungle Bird recipe online that calls for pineapple syrup and lime juice concentrate as well as lime peels. It's from, you know, some recipe. Listen, Mark, don't try. He wants to know how to get the lime concentrate. Don't use that recipe.
I don't know anything about that, but you're the man. You're the man to answer that question.
Yeah. So we used to do these are just questions I have to get through. So, you like talking cocktails. So figure
sure, sure.
So what I would do is I would use Booker and Dax's old stirred bird recipe, which is a stir. So if you're bottling a cocktail, you were taking a cocktail that otherwise wouldn't be good bottled and making it into a stirred thing. So the stirred bird was blackstrap, 1 ounce or one part. Let's call it part because you're going to make lots of them because you're bottled, right? One part like a Crusian blackstrap, 3/4 ounce clarified lime juice. Now, so what I would do if you're going to cordialize, I would heat that 3 parts of clarified lime juice, heat it, and then it'll be stable with peel in it to make like a pseudo cordial, but don't bother boiling it with the sugar because you're going to bottle it all together. Half part clarified pineapple juice, half part pineapple syrup, which is just pineapple juice taken up to 50 bricks. Half part Campari, 1/4 part overproof Jamaican like Smith and Cross, and 1/4 proof light rum like a Flor de Caña, and some salt. Stir it to see how much water it needs to add to the water and bottle it, and that should be pretty stable. And that sounds like a good recipe, not using like lime concentrate. Sounds like a nightmare. And 2/3.
It sounds great.
Yeah. All right. So I can answer more of these questions. Do you like these kinds of questions?
Yeah, I love them. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Is there any insurance technique? This is from Christian Sacco. Is there any insurance technique for emulsifying sauces without egg yolks in a blender? I have the Costco Vitamix. Yeah, I'm sure the Costco Vitamix is as good as any other Vitamix, just cheaper.
Does he mean the blender?
Yeah,
Vitamix makes something for them.
Everybody makes something for, so like, you know, Costco's going to sell it for a lot cheaper than everybody else. So Williams Sonoma doesn't want you to be able to buy the same blender at Costco for cheaper than the one that they, you know what I'm saying? The base of the blender cup is massive and the solid liquids do not immerse well in the blades unless there's a lot of volume. Well, I wonder if the Costco Vitamix can use other Vitamix pitchers. Right? Because the Vitamix makes a wide base pitcher and a narrow base pitcher, but at least in the ones I have, they're pretty interchangeable. As long as you don't have one of those stupid Vitamixes. You know what's happened since you moved to Thailand? They've taken the Vitamixes and they've put like chips in the blender thing so that the base knows what pitcher is on it. It's the worst thing that's ever happened to a Vitamix.
What's the name of those really fancy heater blender things that everybody has in their kitchen?
Thermomix.
Yeah. Every time I talk to, I don't use those because
you're not European.
I don't need to.
Yeah.
But every time I talk to the people, they're like, the first generation of those things were the best ones. Cause they just had a dial. There was no screen. There were no chips or nothing.
Now it's a computer.
Now it's a computer and they hate it.
Yeah. It's also super expensive. Oh, Europeans love it. Americans like can never wrap their head around it because we have like decent blenders. Speaking of blenders, this is a good thing to wrap out on. I saw you give a I saw you basically be the American in charge of David Thompson's speech on Thai food at Star Chefs. It's got to be like 12 years ago. And he was saying that you can't make a good like a curry paste in anything other than a mortar and pestle. Agree or disagree, blender man?
If you are David Thompson, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
If you're anybody else, well, you know, very few people will argue that you can make a better one than in a mortar and pestle. But plenty of people think you can make one that's as good or at least good enough that nobody except David Thompson would know the difference.
There you go. All right. Fair enough. And on the way out, do you remember how we first bonded over a... what was it, 50-pound sack of mangosteens on the roof of a hotel in Panama City?
We went to Panama. We went to the market. It was horrible. There were, like, dead fish laying on the ground with no ice. But we found a bag of mangosteens. And, yes, we went to the rooftop, and we sat there, and we ate almost the entire bag.
Yeah.
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 And then we went to... we ended up getting taken to like a burlesque show.
That was a nightmare.
Yeah.
That place was an unholy nightmare. But the mangosteens were great. The
mangosteens were very good. It's probably the best thing about that trip.
Yeah. Because you know what the nice thing is? When you have a 50-pound sack of mangosteens and a couple of them aren't good, who cares?
Yeah, you just throw them over the shoulder. That's it.
Yeah. Because you have 50 pounds more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man. Well, thanks for coming on, Andy.
Pleasure.
I'll see you tonight at the, what's it called?
The pop-up.
Cooking Issues. Yeah. We didn't talk about the coffee.
Yeah, that's all right.
Thai coffee, it's the new thing.
Yeah.